Welcome back. When I was invited to come here to say words to many people I wouldn't have known beforehand, I thought, well, nice, I've done this before. I've taught 44 years. Words. Little did I know I was going to be on retreat with people I've come to know. And there's something about this village, this place, and this intention that makes it all rich and brings it back. Brings back what we've experienced in the midst. And so I'm going to offer some things. And whether I get through it, I don't know. Because this is a very personal hour. And so it will evoke, I hope, in you things you've been through or have had to go through. Though I've learned enough in these moments already with you at table, hiking, coffeeing, that you've been through a lot. We've come this far. And I think of the psalmists, so teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Thank you, Dorothy. So I'm taking a risk. Thank God Mary Oliver is here. But I am going to read some poems of mine that have been written out of the long farewell with my wife over a 5-year period. So enter at your risk here, but enter holding me in the light as I hold you and all precious life in the light, and hoping there is wisdom. So it's going to be a kind of dialogue between Mary Oliver and my poetry, which are the lesser lights of this dialogue. And it's poetry out of pain and suffering on the one hand, solidarity on the other, and what happens when, as in my family, we always said, look, 4 daughters, one of whom we lost 12 years ago, 13 years ago. The way through is straight through. Or as my grandmother used to say, don't run around the barn. Go straight to it. The way through is straight through, and I'd rather run around the barn. I'd rather avoid it. So, I'll start off with one of mine, and then we'll have some Mary Oliver time, and then as the poems unfold, feel free, please, to comment, and the Mary Oliver poems I know have been important for many of you, and so if they connect with some experience you want to share, please do that. That's what poetry does. It opens up the way through, just like the Psalms. So I'm going to start with a poem that is about language, of course, and about things we name in language. It's called No Dichotomies. The start and stop of the ant, the birth and death of the deer, the growth and decay of the tree, the burst and fade of stars, the hot and cold of love, the rise and fall of empires, all show some vast geography after we say them, write them, as crescendo and decrescendo and the shift of harmonies and the counterpointing rhythms reveal a single composition in the long run. Innumerable contrasts embedded in what our heaving language will not leave disconnected. Dichotomies. That's why poetry is so important. Mary, come to be with us. Mary Oliver, come to be with us. As you know, she loved and lost. And it is about love, isn't it? Over time. A pretty song, a pretty song. How many of you know this? A pretty song by Mary Oliver. Oh, if you don't, then I'm glad you don't. And here's something new. From the complications of loving you, I think there is no end or return. No answer, no coming out of it. Which is the only way to love, isn't it? This isn't a playground. This is earth, our heaven for a while. Therefore, I have given precedence to all my sudden, sullen, dark moods that hold you in the center of my world. And I say to my body, grow thinner still. I say to my fingers, type me a pretty song. And I say to my heart, rave on. Can we give ourselves permission? Even if you've never tried to form words, or if you have tried to form words and they all seem failures, which of course is 96% of what writing poetry is, the failure of language. It's what the best theologians know. We have technical terms for this in theology. Apophatic. There's cataphatic, according to the images, when it's all alive and well in your language and your life, and then there's apophatic. Shut your mouth before the awe of love and the long run of it. So I say to my heart, rave on, even when your words fail. Thank you, Mary Oliver. And here's a nice sensual one from her about her and her partner called Those Days. When I think of her, I think of the long summer days she lay in the sun, how she loved the sun, how we spread our blanket and our friends came and the dogs played. And then I would get restless and get up and go off into the woods and the fields. And the afternoon would soften gradually, and finally I would come home through the long shadows and into the house where she would be, my glorious welcoming, tan and hungry and ready to tell the hurtless gossips of the day, and how I listened leisurely while I put around the room flowers in jars of water, daisies, butter and eggs, and everlasting, until like our lives, they trembled and shimmered everywhere. I told you, I warned you. I'll save one of hers because it's better than mine for a little bit later. Yeah, I need relief. So this, have you ever looked for a recipe in that book of recipes you inherited from your family and couldn't find it? This was a recipe written in the hand of our daughter, Carrie. And it was after we lost her. And it was Thanksgiving. And I was desperate for the recipe. You know those family recipes. This is for yum yum yams. And I'm sure you've had some version of yum yum yams. Maybe the same darn recipe. I don't know where she got it. Get the books down and search. Look for the yum yum yams. Can't have Thanksgiving without them. The taste, the texture, the pecans on top. So I did unfold the pages, searching for the single 3x5 that holds the secret plot, the elements for giving thanks with taste buds and yummy faces. No finding. But wait, here, amid the pages, the clippings, the grease-splotted lists and strategies, beloved handwriting emerged. Ancestral guides, friends lists, lost parents, witnesses to other meals, inked testimonies to precisely sensed kitchen pots and pans, people arranged round other tables on the shadowed edges of memory until now, flipping through these pages, they all came back, all assembled on this kitchen counter. If memory, tears and former happiness, connections to the flesh, if these could make the recipe, I'd get to it now. Yet, when Carrie's hand-bearing greased cards appeared after Thanksgiving, hiding on the floor of the pantry, there was more yum of vivid memory than could be prepared in many feasts. And some of you have been through this and are in the midst of it. Ah, how daily the long farewell is. How daily it is. I couldn't write a poem about bed sores. I just couldn't. But they were there, and that's daily, isn't it? That's daily. I mean, eventually bed sores. Not in the beginning. Not when words were still available, halting and difficult. Not when a little mobility was still left. But I never could write about the bed sores. But I'm working on a poem now about the handheld child's puppet that my wife used as a children's librarian again and again to delight so many young ones. And so when her language failed for the last year, there was the bear. Yes. No. Yippee! Happy. Not today. That was good. That Gerber baby food that you fixed, that was good. I don't have that poem with me, but you hear it coming on. it's coming on. It'll get here. Are you okay? I'm not. Okay. Imperfection. This was perhaps a couple of years. This is March of 2008. She died 18 months ago, March of 2011. Imperfection. Why this halting step? Why so hard to swallow? Even the wise come from the partial presence. Brain fumbling toward what we are asking. We become what the wise are. It all falls short as we do, no matter who or what. Even with the occasional flash of form, a streak of melody, a gestured feeling of perception, some temporary resilient strength. All occasions fill with ache. We want forever here. Everything fulfilled, full, flourishing against and within us falls the perishing. We go against the fading, the fleeting glimpses of what's no longer. Do we know we're in ignorance? Trembling amidst the crumbling towers and the odd motions of hands, against the persistent wind outside the window of the limbs in the wheelchair by the window, gazing. Well, she said, nothing's perfect. So subject to sorrow, so healing, so true. We are left with the sad misconception, take it whenever you can, they say. But such taking brings no possessing of the perfect we cannot have or be. My wife was capable of zingers. We didn't have many arguments. We were polite Midwesterners. And both had alcoholism in the family, and too many arguments, too many memories of harsh words that couldn't be taken back. So we vowed early on to take it easy, avoid the big Italian-esque collisions. So, vanilla, vanilla. But she was capable of one-line zingers, like the time one of my graduate school students came to the door in really ripped old jeans, you know, the knees out, and this really dirty, ratty t-shirt, and he came bringing a part of his dissertation, and she met him at the front door. She was still mobile at that time. And polite Episcopalian he was, he said, well, how are you, Mrs. Saliers? She looked at his jeans. She looked at his really dirty t-shirt. And she said, well, I feel a lot better than you look. That may well have been behind this poem, this imperfection. Well, nothing's perfect, she said, relieving me of a transition I was going through. You know when the prayers are, oh, please, God, send a miracle, sustain this, change this, reverse this thing. And when your prayers do then change, give us strength now. Give us some sign that we both recognize nothing's perfect here, and God knows what's ahead of us. Well, later we know what was ahead of us. Later. And we look forwards and understand backwards, of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nothing's perfect here. That's what makes eschatology so attractive. Thank you once again, Fred, for this morning. Okay. Let's go a little less step further in. This is just after. This is one of those times when you begin to try to take in what's been given in such a journey as this. This is a poem that some of you know, this form of poetry where the first phrase of the next line is the last phrase of the line before, and this just fell out. It's called It's the Silences. I say it's the silences that get me most. Get me most where no defense is mounted. No defense is mounted in days like this. In days like this, where conversations once were, now the spaces, full of traces and phantom sounds. But there's music in proximity. In proximity, the arms, the face, the whole body next, to me, yet next to me, yet the love that was and is, now altered. I say it's the music that gets me most together and apart from her. Apart from her, I imagine hearing as it was, there was sighing and singing in the night, sighing at the beauty, lost now, begets me music and silence, spaces between the notes, Between the notes, the lost sound echoing in the imagined ear hearing what's not recovered is the perishing love coming back, but from silence. Oh, Mary, bring us some relief here. But she isn't going to in this poem. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among the lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind, and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. I know it's coming close. I know it's conjuring. It's just this way here, east of Eden. It's this sometimes unspeakable freedom of the created order. You know, this unspeakability of how it is. Was it Eliot who said, humankind can't stand that much reality? Yeah, we can't. We can't try to say it all the time. We need Barney or Walt Disney or something else, some distraction. But once you've tasted the sound and seen the music, you don't go home again, do you? And so, as in the title of Maxwell's wonderful novel, Time Will Darken It. Okay. I'll save one of Mary's very best to the very end because it'll come back at Vespers tonight. It's like things that keep echoing, right? Come back. All right. Now this time I'm going to read something that I want you to comment on. Have you ever been where I am when I'm writing this? This is after now. This is after. And I want to know whether you've been here. What solidarity do we have? I've already talked with some of you, and I know, but I got to hear it from you. Otherwise, I'm just sitting up here by myself. This is called confounding beauty. A day when all blue and green, shimmering in the sunlight, everywhere to be seen, while wind obverses the leaves white, piercing the soul clean and transfiguring all in sight. Standing under the oak tree here, stopped dumb in my running course, the singing birds rejoice the ear and sound my heart to its source, beyond what the senses merely tell to my body's pulsing course. Tell me, sun, sky, and trees, why you bring me to my senses, my weight on my knees. Here, now, before I cross the fences to another path in open seas of waving meadow where more wonder commences. You have no answer but what you are, as we have no theories to explain the mysteries of earth and distant star. Thus, we understand the exquisite pain of love, loss, beauty, life, and the far confounding beauty the divine must contain. Maybe I better read that again. The rhyme scheme is a little more complicated here. So it's A, B, A, B, C, and so on and so on. Let me try that one again, okay? Is that all right? Because okay. I want to know, have you had days and hours like this? If they don't come to you at Holden Village, you should be hosed down. Yeah, this is a Holden Lake hike day. A day when all blue and green, shimmering in the sunlight, everywhere to be seen, while wind obverses the leaves white, piercing the soul clean and transfiguring all in sight. Standing under the oak tree here, stopped dumb in my running course, the singing birds rejoice the ear and sound my heart to its source beyond what the senses merely tell to my body's pulsing course. Tell me, sun, sky, and trees, why you bring me to my senses, my weight on my knees. Here, now, before I cross the fences to another path in open seas of waving meadow where more wonder commences. You have no answer but what you are, as we have no theories to explain the mysteries of earth and distant star. Thus, we understand the exquisite pain of love, loss, beauty, life, and the far confounding beauty the divine must contain. And I'm wondering if you've had moments where the sheer sensual moment of nature, of the natural order, of Gerard Manley Hopkins' Inscape and Instress, of this moment, and then you step back from it and you begin to understand something, and you may not have words for it. But have you been there? Well, what would be an example?
I actually wrote a poem about it, but I was walking on Mount Pleasant Avenue, which is near my home, and it was in springtime, so the cherry trees and apple trees were in blossom, and it was a breezy day anyway, but a sudden puff sent these white blossoms just exploding from the tree, and I was just caught in the middle of it. And I called it glory. It was just a moment, but yeah, exactly as you were talking about. I didn't fall to my knees physically, but I sure was there in here. Yeah.
I was struck, any of you who saw the film, the puzzling and flawed film, a wonderful film in some ways, of the tulip tree, I think it was.
Magnolia.
And of course, those base shots of the big tree. And I take it that you you understood something.
Well, and I had somebody, I remembered it, my arms kind of went up. They just did. And there was a man who drove by on his car. And he lifted his cell phone at the same time. But it was just, you know, it was just as reflexive as mine was. Just, yeah.
Here's to you.
Yeah, here's to you.
That was another. Yeah.
I'm thinking of hearing Lorraine Hunt Lieberson sing the Bach cantata when I don't know any time in my life when I've been transported like that, where my whole body was just alive and in awe in a new way. And then it's made more that memory is more poignant by her untimely death.
Yeah.
And I think her music still, you know, I hadn't heard of her before, really. And I virtually got every CD that I could get to treasure that. But it was this, it was a real a transporting, almost out of body experience where I just felt my whole body was just like shivering. And it was this certain passage, this sort of melismatic passage where it was just like.
The Mary Oliver is shimmering, trembling and shimmering. Yeah. Yes.
I find these to be pure gift in that there's no way I can construct, contrive, schedule, wish, thirst for. They're just gifts. And I think my only response other than to see glory is to be attentive, to put myself in places as a lifestyle, to be there when the gift knocks.
I think you speak for us all, yeah. Let's put ourselves in places where the conditions may be such that the gift comes. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing what some of those places are. I was a young mother, distracted by many things. And we'd gone out to an Amish farm, and I was rowing a boat on a little farm pond. And on the hillside, the trees began to shimmer, and I heard the sound of a bell, a single note. And I said, God, are you the bell or the clapper in the bell? And out of that sound that didn't stop came a great rolling yes. And then I looked down at my hands, and they were still on the oars, and I don't know if that was 3 seconds or 3 minutes or 30 minutes, but it was really real. An Ohio farm pond.
Yeah. I grew up in Ohio.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
They happen all the time, but the one I want to share was we were living in Philadelphia, and I went outside, and there was a stunning double rainbow, just shimmering, you know, in the clouds, or that lovely smoky gray. It was just arresting. And I stood outside for as long as I could, and I came back inside, and I had the radio on, and there were more accidents on the Schuylkill, the expressway, because people were arrested by this double rainbow, and there were crashes right in front. So that's just such a fascinating juxtaposition from the wonder, beauty, stop, you know, powers, rushing, all that stuff.
That's it. The shadow side of beauty. That's lovely. That's interesting. For some of us, sight is primary. For some of us, sound is primary. Music. I'm hopelessly acoustical, but I learn from people whose primary access to this is sight. And then for some of us, it's touch. And for others, it may well be fragrance and taste. And we're given these gifts at birth. And sometimes they're taken from us, of course, and eventually hardly taken from us, but they constitute God's sensorium. I think of it as a sensorium of grace. And when we're confounded by beauty, when something epiphs, you know, sometimes I look at the church and I say, does anything ever epiph here? And as a liturgist, you know, working hard to make epiphany epiph, there's an anomaly for you. There's a console.
That just reminds me of this morning, that just the question, if we're here to be here for others, what are they here for? And it sounds like that's what they're here for, the rest of the senses, that we can't,
yes,
we can't of ourselves, though we physically have them all, can't really respond to all of it, and together we can have it all.
Yeah, and that's why we need one another. When these things happen, and you all have had these happen, these moments, these exquisite moments, sometimes I think they're profoundly synesthetic. Sight and sound go together, and the ear starts to see, and the eye starts to taste, and the tongue not only speaks, but understands. Oh, taste and
see,
said the psalmist. Which, of course, in ritual context for Christians, for the Eucharistic context, is something I think we keep bringing back because it keeps being given to us to taste and see something. So I often think that these moments that arrest us are little clues to the synesthesis of God. Now, those of us who are musicians know about the music of Olivier Messiaen, who actually heard colors. It was a real synesthete in the technical sense. But don't you have the feeling that from time to time God grants us a very grace-filled synesthetic moment? And sometimes it need not be out in nature or anything like this. Have any of you heard someone's voice and suddenly it's a voice out of your own experience? It sounds like, reminds you of. So it can be very humble circumstances. There was an elderly man in the church I grew up in who every Christmas had to sing Jesu Bambino. His name was Barton, Charles Barton. And I can still see him and still hear him. And may it be given to us that we have these moments in which time is arrested, you know, and we're confounded. Gerard Manley Hopkins. The beauty was there, but the beholder wanting, which two, once they meet, the heart rears wings and hurls, oh, half hurls earth off from under my feet. And boy, did he have suffering. Didn't ever think, I mean, think of Emily, of Amherst. Anyway. Confounding beauty. So, the sheer thingness of things, it's what the old scholastics talk about when they talked about the thingness, the hechitas, what it is. Okay. All right. The question why happens so much when we're undergoing these long periods, isn't it? I mean, why? I mean, it was in the film, the Job, the riffs on Job. You know, why? So here's a poem called Why, and this is on the far side. This is where you get enough distance to see what the whys, what was behind your whys. Just for once, unstress the why. Be an ant or a beetle, or go about working as the bee. No, no, better, sing and fly, bird-like, without the burden. Blessed be the beetle and the ant, the buzzing bee near the flower, and the singing birds this bright morning. The beetle and the ant, don't ask why, scurrying as they are just now, the first in a straight line, orderly, determined, the other stopping and starting a frenetic scuttle of work. Nor the bees, rational as they are, collecting, dancing, combing for the sweet good of the planet. So I ask, why do I ask why? Why do we, walking in solemn lines or frenetically searching amidst all this unhappiness, why do we become our whys? Throw your whys away. They'll come back, trust me. Why do birds sing anyway? Another one of those arresting moments for us, once somehow the burden of grief begins to lift and we start observing things like beetles and ants and stuff. Why? That was March of this year, for heaven's sakes. That was good. Okay. Now here is one for those of us who have counted more years than some of the rest of us. And this might be connected with Mary Oliver's, that first poem I read about those days, the suntan, the good days that are brought back to us on the far side. This is called Moon Pool. Have you observed? There was a Blake moon for a while last night until it got free of the scoop of mountains back here. And then you could almost read the newspaper. And if we stayed long enough, we could. I think if the smoke goes away. Did you know what I mean by the Blake moon? The Blake drawings? You know, those, okay. Well, if you don't worry about it. Anyway, Moon Pole. It was a curious moon awaking old urges. It kept saying, you've had your turn. The round cool orb, the satin dark of night, the sky sequined veil off and trailing. It kept saying, you've had your turn. Go with the pull, pulled out and under, the tides of body and soul drawn up and down. I've seen you over time in many cycles, she says. The moon keeps whispering in luminous, husky voice, yes, come. But you had your turn. Any of you have been on a moon howl? I was on a Methodist retreat in Texas. One of the women said, come on out, there's a full moon, and we had not noticed it. So we all went out by the lake, Lake Texahoma. Anyone from that part of the country? Texahoma. Let me tell you, it's not Holden Lake. It's not Hart Lake. I'm not even going to compare. What? Anyway, we went out there, and there it was, nonetheless, shimmering on the lake. And so we howled and howled and howled. I had my turn. Yes, come. So this business of what happens to us once we've been given the ambiguous, painful gift of going through perishing. What is the great hoo-ha about this? The great hilaritas about this? We say, oh, we've been through it. Oh, we've been through the perishing. Oh, we survived. And learned a lot. Learned a lot along the way. We're taught a lot. Well, what is the great hoo-ha? We're perishing. And so the preciousness of all, the beetle, the ant, the trees, reclamation projects. Being with people you didn't think were your friends, who are your friends now forever, ever, ever. Because you've had one little epiphany moment with them. Remember the ending of Babette's Feast. If you haven't seen it, run to Netflix or wherever. I don't know where you get these, but run to the show. And remember, the soldier comes back and he presides at this table of the great feast that Babette has prepared for this Lutheran group, you know, who were so scared, you know, of the cooking and the strange things that this French Catholic woman, who was a chef, did. But you remember the end, in which they're all at the banquet table. I can't forget the little bird-like woman who was told, don't taste the wine. You remember her face? She's there, and she takes this wine, and then she goes, just like that. Just like that. Against her fears and against all that she's been warned against. Well, anyway, you know, the old general gets up, who had fallen in love to one of the daughters of this sectarian group long, long ago. And she's at table, and they're all older now. And finally he says, you know, after he recognizes the chef's wine and the chef's cooking of Babette's from the French cafe, and then he says, but it's all given back. It's all given back this time. That can happen against all reason. It really can happen. Not complete, not perfection, but. And that's the way I sometimes think of the Eucharist. And sometimes, not all. I mean, look, there are a lot of flat EKG Sundays when nothing epiphs, and it's hard to think that you're in the presence of the divine because all you have is self-taste. All you can taste is yourself. That's right, man, and how it gets true. And then something happens, and you realize in this meal, with this cup, and this bread, with these people, it's being given back. And that can happen. It doesn't always happen. And the world is full of the ongoing pains, too much of it, too much unrelief. But for those of us who have experienced a teasing taste of that release, that having been given back, we need to witness to that. And sometimes I think the church's vocation is just simply to try to witness to the fact that this is what God desires. That on the far end of it all, it can be restored. I mean, Dame Julian of Norwich, and all manner of things shall be well, and all shall be well. It's been given occasionally for us to taste that. So I think of personal poetry and poetry that becomes part of a tradition and appreciated that speaks of the undergoing of the world, the suffering of the world, the paschal figuration of our daily lives. Poetry and music and art, and let us never forget, humble human lives will witness to that. And we do well to pay attention. You know, it's like Mary Oliver. Pay attention, she says. And then say something if you can. And even if you can't, you know. I mean, it's like those days when you know. I mean, I can't understand why sometimes I can't understand why certain music causes me to think I really understand. And then I can't say. I think we need to prompt that in one another, and that's I think at least one of the gifts of poetry. And before I read the final little poetic paragraph from her volume called Thirst, I want to know if anything else you'd like to share that's sort of come out of these offerings or these poems. Yes.
This is a poem that I think Mary Oliver wrote for you. It's called "The Poet Always Carries a Notebook." What is he scribbling on the page? Is there snow in it or fire? Is it the beginning of a poem? Is it a love note?
How did she know? How do these poets and musicians and artists, weavers who weave dates and names, how do they know? It's what we share. That's the great solidarity. That's the great solidarity. Not just in creation, but in redemption. And I think in these paradigms of going through this kind of suffering and grief and trying to come out on the other side, it's more like we have creation restored to us on the far side of redemption. It's more like the scripture works, if I may be Lutheran for a moment. Oh, everyone should have a really great doctrine of creation. But don't forget, it didn't come about that. And go through a little passage in order to have it restored and to know what the song of creation really is. I think we can learn that. And we were thinking this morning about, some of us were buzzing a little bit about the centurion's witness at the cross there. Why would the centurion, shouldn't the centurion have said, "Well, he deserves that. He said too much, or he did too much, or something, or this is what good." So out of the mouth of a Gentile violent man, or at least a man who was schooled in violence, comes this first witness, you know, truly this was God in flesh. So we talked a little bit about that. So that's a mystery. You know, what was going on in his mind? What, as I wanted to say, what else did he hear and know? Was he kind of a secret admirer who heard things that then all came together when he heard, "Forgive them"? Or, anyway. Okay, well, we're coming to the end of our minutes. Right? Our minutes. We come to the end of our minutes. And let's let Mary Oliver, since she's hovering with such a presence here this morning, anyway. And what a delicious thing to have a conversation with Mary Oliver. This is the ending of and so many of you know this. Maybe you've memorized it. Thirst. "Another morning I wake with thirst for the goodness I do not have. I walk out to the pond, and all the way God has given us such beautiful lessons. Oh, Lord, I was never a quick scholar, but sulked and hunched over my books past the hour and the bell. Grant me, in your mercy, a little more time. Love for the earth and love for you are having such a long conversation in my heart. Who knows what will finally happen or where I will be sent? Yet already I have given a great many things away, expecting to be told to pack nothing except the prayers which, with this thirst, I am slowly learning." We have so much to learn from each other, and I hope this few moments have have been helpful, and at least through a couple of people's verses, we catch sight of that again.
Do you know how her health is right now? I know she was really, really ill.
I do not know. Does anyone know where she is in her journey?
Recently, I couldn't find her.
I think illness and diminishment has come, but I'm sorry, I don't know.
And she was born in Ohio.
Yes. Near the Buckeye, yeah. Thank you for, yes.
I'd just like to add this up here. I recently heard an anecdote about someone who had contacted her about using her poetry liturgically, that is to basically put together a sort of setting of the Mass using her language. And she wrote back and said, absolutely not.
Right.
The book, the language of the Book of Common Prayer cannot be surpassed.
I know.
Well, it was actually not Mary who wrote it. It was Molly.
Right.
Molly did it. Well, let's. Since it's almost high noon, and we are older than we were when we first began. I do want to recommend to you that longer.
Mm-hmm.
Longer poem she has called Making the House Ready for the Lord, and the other one on prayer. But there is this, which we'll end with this little one, praying. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but a doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. That's a good way to end, isn't it? Thanks for coming.